All right. How's everybody doing today? Is this the last talk of the day? Is that just why it's so empty, or is there just no Azure customers that really want to do virtual machines? What's that? I know, but that's okay. So how many of you are actually today using Windows Azure for platform as a service? How many of you have been waiting to do virtual machines? All right, I like those numbers. About the same. No. All right, so last question. How many of you have actually seen any of the virtual machine talks this week? Only two? Uh-oh, okay. So no fear, we'll talk about virtual machines. So what I'm going to talk about today is just some of the, it's a little bit of the deeper talk of how you actually take some of these scenarios, not just like a, you know, migrate a Hello World application up to the cloud, but how do you actually migrate a real application up to the cloud? I'm going to cover a little bit about virtual networking as well. I know there's a virtual networking talk going on at the exact same time, so I felt it was my obligation to copy all this content and do this demo, since you guys went and see it. So we're going to talk about hybrid, building hybrid architectures, and basically how you actually manipulate and deal with virtual machines up in the cloud. So our agenda today is I'm going to talk a little bit about motivation and app selection, basically which workloads actually do go to the cloud, some of the different approaches you can take to actually doing a migration. I'm going to cover virtual networking. Going to talk a little bit about extending identity with infrastructure service. So, sorry, one more question. How many of you have anything to do with Active Directory organization? Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about AD in the cloud and managing application data and a little bit of PaaS integration. So when I've been talking to customers a whole lot the past few months about virtual machines. We haven't been able to talk about it very publicly, but we've been doing some NDA level discussions where we're asking them, you know, what do you want to do? Why are you interested in the cloud? And the top three things I keep hearing from everyone is that the main reason they want to go to the cloud is because they're tired of managing their data center. They want some agility in the data center. They don't want to have to wait to order servers. They don't want to have to wait to unbox them and pack them up and stick them in racks and get the cabling and SAN ready. They would really just like the ability to spin up a couple of servers and same day, same hour would be best. So agility is a really important motivator for moving workloads out to the cloud. A second thing, really motivation, is focus. If your organization's IT is spending a lot of time managing infrastructure, which is cabling and storage and all the good stuff, they're not spending more time trying to make your organization money, right? That's for the most part, that's what most organizations are bound for. And the third one is obviously economics. It's really expensive to run your own data center. So cloud computing, we have the data centers. We've already put that giant investment into it. So you get the economies of scale savings. And if you're familiar with any kind of platform as a service cloud computing talks, you probably have seen this slide. If you haven't seen the slide, it's actually really interesting. This is what we used to talk to customers about whenever we were saying, okay, if you want to go to the cloud, these are some of the target workloads that we've traditionally went after that just makes total sense to move out to the cloud. The first one is the on and off scenario. This is applications that, you know, say you're a 9-to-5 shop. You have a bunch of servers that are sitting around after 5:30 p.m. after everyone's home collecting dust. There's absolutely nothing going on those servers until 9 o'clock the next morning. So why are you paying for them? You know, you had to pay for the electricity, you had to pay for the actual servers. You paid for a full-time system, and you're only using it part-time. So that's where cloud computing could come to the rescue, because you can turn these computing capacity on only whenever you actually need them. The second traditional workload is the unpredictable bursting. This is the one where you're running a website, and your marketing guy comes up with the absolute best marketing campaign ever, and you have this gigantic spike in usage, and you as the IT person have to accommodate that. So if you're hosting all your own hardware or you're hosting it in a non-agile environment, how do you do that? Do you compensate or do you over-provision and, you know, plan for 180% of what you normally do? Or what do? Or do you just lose whenever that ad comes out? Do you send back server too busy and you just fail? not an easy scenario, right? You're either paying too much or you're not doing your job. The third one is the absolute best problem to have. It's a growing fast problem. It's just your company, organization is growing so fast, your IT people are constantly just updating and updating and updating their hardware. Finally, the predictable bursting. This is the one, and this actually happens a ton in enterprise organizations, where at the end of the month, they do order processing, they do receipts, they do some kind of batch processing that just drives a huge amount of demand on computing resources, but the rest of the time, they don't really use that hardware very much. So, you know, it's another case of wasted capacity, where you have the hardware capacity, but you're not using it effectively. So with infrastructure as service, we've kind of expanded the scope of what we're actually targeting. We're not just targeting the traditional PaaS workloads like we were before. I mean, granted, if you wanted to move your workload in before, we'd been happy to accommodate as well, but this is not the only story that we're telling. What we're really telling with infrastructure as service is it's all about the app. It's not the pattern. It's just moving applications out of the cloud so they're not managed in your data center anymore. This could be custom line of business applications. It could be any kind of CRM, ERP, random acronym of the day type of application. We're looking for file servers, databases, dev and test environments. And I think one of the ones that's going to be really big challenge and very popular with corporations slowly dipping their toes into cloud computing is going to be hybrid. And every enterprise customer I've talked to, they don't want to pick up their entire data center and drop it up in the cloud. They just are not going to do it, probably never will. What they will do is, if the capabilities are there, is they will move pieces of their infrastructure out to the cloud. In order to do that, you can't just pick up an application and move it out to the cloud that's been running on your enterprise network for a long time because it's not reachable anymore. All the other resources that are around it pretty much orphan it. So one of the key investments we've made with this launch is virtual networking, which allows you to have a virtual private network, a site-to-site network between your on-premises data center and the public cloud. So before we get too excited and just pick up all your applications and start moving them out, there are a couple of things you should consider before whenever you're picking your applications. The first one is software requirements. Does your application require running on Server 2003 32-bit? Okay, probably not a good candidate because we only have a 64-bit hypervisor. We do not run 32-bit operating systems, period. So it's stuff like that you have to consider. Just to be clear, 32-bit applications will run on a 64-bit OS. It's just if you have a 32-bit OS requirement, then it's not good. Other issues, licensing. You know, software companies are not known for simple licensing. We have tons and tons of complex licensing models. You need to check with your vendor, your software vendor, including Microsoft, whether the license, whatever you're running, is transferable to the cloud. Are the licenses transferable? Third one is hardware requirements. If you're currently running an application that has a requirement for 4 physical network cards or some kind of hardware appliance, well, you can't really just pick these kind of custom hardware up and drop it in our data center. So that's probably another one that is not a good fit. So now that we've kind of laid out what types of applications we're thinking about for migrating out to the cloud, let's talk about some of the different approaches you can take to do it. So there's really 3 key migration patterns that I'm thinking customers will use as they start going forward. The first one is a forklift migration. And this is the idea that you pick up an entire application, everything it touches, and move it out to the cloud. And it is entirely feasible for certain types of applications. If you have a content website, if you have a blog application, something that doesn't have dependencies on every other application in your enterprise, it might be a good fit. If it's not, if you're bringing your SharePoint farm out to the internet, there's probably a good chance that your SharePoint farm has dependencies on Active Directory or maybe SAP or maybe some other data source within your enterprise. So forklift's probably not the best approach for that. What would probably be a better approach would be the hybrid migration. And this is where you establish that site-to-site network tunnel and you move the application itself, but you leave the dependencies back on premises. So this is the dip your toes in the water approach. Or depending on the application, it could be much more than your toes. And the third approach is a PaaS migration with infrastructure service. Now, if you're not familiar with PaaS, whenever we throw these terms around, what they really mean in Windows Azure sense is Windows or web and worker roles. Web and worker roles are our classic computing model where you could build an application, put it up in the cloud. We do health monitoring. We do OS patching. We do basically all the management of it. So you're just building the application. So integration with PaaS and IS is really key because one of the things we found out whenever customers were trying to build new applications based on our PaaS model is that they had dependencies that we couldn't accommodate. They had a dependency on SQL Server full-text search, for instance. Okay, SQL Azure is great, but it just doesn't support full-text search. So you either had to rewrite your search methodology, or you had to wait for this, or go somewhere else. So we're hoping one of the things that infrastructure service will do is unblock these migrations, building new applications in platform as a service and using virtual machines as the dependency unblocker. So if you have virtual machines on site, if you're running System Center, Hyper-V, all that good stuff, you have virtual machines, how do you migrate these up into the cloud? Or if you have applications that are running on these that you're wanting to move up. So the first scenario that you might want to consider is migrating, just picking up the VHD running in your private cloud and migrating it directly up to the cloud. It sounds like probably the best approach because a lot of applications have a lot of really complicated installation procedures. A lot of applications installed in enterprises, I bet there's a good chance that some people just don't have any idea how they were installed and how they were configured. Windows isn't known for having all your configuration for an application in a simple, easy-to-use place. There's registry settings, there's file permissions, et cetera, mismatched DLLs. So the good news about this approach is you're taking an application that's in a working, known state, picking it up and dropping it in the cloud, and hoping it'll work. The downside is you're absolutely uploading a VHD. Depending on the size, that could take a long time. If you're uploading a 70 gig VHD file, that could take many, many hours. The other problem here is virtual machines running on your private network. The hypervisor there is not exactly the same as the capabilities we have in the cloud. So Hyper-V on-premises supports multiple NICs, for instance. We only support a single NIC. And of course, you have access to more hardware on your on-premises network. So if you have dependencies on scanners and stuff like that, it's something that you would have to take into consideration before you picked it up and dropped it in the cloud. The other option, if you're brand new to Windows Azure IIS, is you do not have to actually upload a VHD. You don't have to upload a 70 gig VHD to the cloud. You can just go through our management portal or any of our other tools, create a brand new virtual machine off of one of our templates, Server 2008, Server 2012, Linux, whatever operating system image we support, build it directly in the cloud, and this lowers your upload time at a minimum because you're provisioning it directly. There's no upload at all, and it's also diminishing your dependency risk. The downside is now you're back to the point of having to figure out how to reinstall and reconfigure that application, and depending on the complexity of it, this may or may not be a big deal. So a couple of things to take away whenever you're considering migrating virtual machines is Windows Azure currently supports a VHD file format. So if your format is VHDX or anything else, you'll have to convert it to VHD first. We do provide a tool to actually upload these images. It's called CS Upload. It comes with the Windows Azure 1.7 SDK. And the reason you want to use CS Upload for uploading images is it's actually pretty intelligent on how it does it. It does support resuming failed transfer. So again, if you're uploading that 70 gig disk, you get network disconnected, you don't have to start over. You actually can start where the tool left off. The other thing about Windows Azure Storage is we do not support, or not Windows Azure Storage, but virtual machines, is we do not support dynamic disks. So if your VHD is currently configured to a dynamic disk, and you upload it using some other tool other than CS Upload, it will just not boot whenever you configure a VM for it. So CS Upload is smart enough to detect that you're running a dynamic disk and actually convert it on the fly as you upload it. The third thing that's really interesting about CS Upload is it's really efficient how it does its upload. So if you think about most of your disks in a virtual machine, a significant portion of it is going to be actually written with data files and operating system files and all that, but there's also a significant portion of it that's just empty free space. And CS Upload has a shortcut and it will actually not upload that space. One more thing you should remember before you actually upload your VM is once it's up in the cloud, you have to access it remotely, so make sure that remoting is enabled. So if you upload it without any method of accessing it remotely, it's not very useful. So just my PowerPoint magic showing you how a typical VM migration would look like. So this is your on-premises virtual machine. It's just a typical server. It has 8 gigs of memory, 4 cores. It's only using HTTP 80 and 443 for endpoints. It's just a web server. It probably has SQL Express on it, because if you notice down at the bottom, it does have a D and an E drive. So we do have a VM with 3 disks on it. So the first step, if you were going to migrate this virtual machine up to the cloud, would be you would use CSUpload and actually upload the VHDs. Knowing the risks, you would upload the VHDs. The second is in the portal or from PowerShell, you would actually create a virtual machine. And whenever you create that virtual machine, you need to specify which disk is the actual bootable VHD, which one is the OS disk. The third step is to actually configure the data disks. Data disk 1 would be your app data. Data disk 2 would be app logs. And you notice one thing, the Azure PM is not in the room, otherwise I'd pick on him for this. But one thing you should notice is on your on-premises, you have a CD and an E drive, and in the cloud, you now have a C, E, and an F drive. And the reason for that is because the D drive is actually reserved in a virtual machine up in the cloud. It's actually a reference to the local physical disk on the server. So don't put data there you want to keep forever. So the fourth thing is if you actually are using the D drive, whenever your server boots up, it's not going to have the right material on it, so you do need to adjust the app configuration to accommodate that D drive. And finally, now we have load balancing. You have to remember to configure external access to this application. So you're going to be in the Windows Azure Management Portal and configuring endpoints in the load balancer so people can actually browse to your website. So let's kind of walk through what it would actually look like just to do this using the tools. I'm not going to actually upload 70 gigs, though, so you don't have to wait that long. Okay, so this is my demo machine here. What I want to show first is basically these are some of the command line tools that you would use. I know it's not really exciting just seeing an .exe file, but CSUpload is the utility you will use to upload VHDs if you are doing a virtual machine migration. So an example application I have is I have two servers here, or actually 3 servers, two web servers and a SQL server. And I'm going to kind of walk you through the steps of how you would actually migrate this little application up to the cloud. So the first step, and you can actually do this all at once, but I'll show you one at a time. The first step would actually be to call CSUpload with the add disk argument and basically tell it all the disks that you want to upload. This actually doesn't configure the virtual machine. What it does is it uploads the VHDs to Windows Azure Storage, and it adds a reference in the Windows Azure metadata that points back to each one of these as a disk. So at this point, all you're doing is just configuring a disk. One other interesting thing to note is at the end of these is the first one has -OS, so it tells the Windows Azure Fabric controller what the actual operating system is, and that's also basically marks it as bootable. So you can kind of think of this as disk part for the cloud. The other two are just data disks. So if you upload them, you try to create a VM off of it, they won't boot. So this would be our first step. We'd actually run this command, depending on how much bandwidth we have, tells you how much time you'll have to wait before it's actually uploaded. Once it's actually uploaded, though, that's whenever you would go and configure a VM off of it. So I've already uploaded all these disks to the cloud, and you can see in the portal that I have a bunch of these funny disk names and the locations pointing to these where I uploaded them in blob storage. So virtual machines in Windows Azure are all backed by, they're not backed by physical disks on the machines, they're actually backed by Windows Azure Storage. So that's why you see the location is off to an HTTP endpoint. So these are your C and your D and your F drives, not your D. So let me show you a quick way of how you would actually provision one of these. How many are you familiar with PowerShell? All right.
That's better. You guys are more familiar with PowerShell than you are Azure.
So I'm going to, this script right here, there it goes. So this script right here is what you would actually write in PowerShell if you wanted to take those uploaded VHDs, attach them to a virtual machine, and have it boot up. You don't have to do this. You can actually go through the portal and do this, have the exact same experience. The only difference is it's a little bit more serialized. You'll have to create the virtual machine and then attach to disk after the fact. But just to kind of walk through what this is there's three variables that have the name of our disks. These map directly to right here. These map exactly to what we saw in the Windows Azure portal that we uploaded. And then we have a commandlet, which I just overwrote, called new Azure VM config. And this commandlet basically creates a configuration object that you can then manipulate to configure your virtual machine up in the cloud. It allows you to add the two data disks that we uploaded and to add any additional endpoints, like if we wanted to open up port 1433 or port 80 or whatever. We can manipulate this all in one shot, and then whenever down at the bottom, we call new Azure VM, and it will take that configuration and actually go create the virtual machine up in the cloud. So as you can see, I have one virtual machine. It's a domain controller, and we'll talk about that here in just a bit. So I'll go ahead and run this. And assuming I didn't mess anything up last time I wrote it, it should actually take those disks and provision a virtual machine for us. So it takes a few minutes for it to boot. So the next thing is how, you know, we saw the steps on how you actually migrate a single virtual machine. How would you actually migrate one that has multiple servers in it? So one of the things that Windows Azure is a little bit unique about is all of our virtual machines, well, not all of our virtual machines, but our virtual machines they have a container model. So within Windows Azure, there's a concept called a cloud service that has a public endpoint. That's the public IP address that you can hit your VMs at. And within that cloud service, you can actually have multiple virtual machines in it. And you can have multiple cloud services, too, with multiple public IPs. But this is something that you'll need to understand whenever you're architecting these solutions, is the cloud service is a container, a network boundary. So as we add multiple virtual machines to the cloud service, they're all basically on the same network. That's really the key takeaway you have. All the virtual machines in the same cloud service can all communicate to each other directly. So just to point out one thing in our PowerShell script, whenever I created this virtual machine on the new Azure VM argument, I have a parameter called service name. Service name is our cloud service. So whenever you create a new cloud service, you can then add multiple virtual machines to it and get them on the same network. And the other thing to note is the dash location parameter. This is the switch that tells you which data center to provision this new virtual machine in. You could literally provision one in East Coast, one in the West Coast, one in Asia, one in Europe, all in the same script. So you can see in the portal that our virtual machine is booting up now. It's in stop state, but it's actually provisioned, and it's getting to the point where it'll boot up. And by the way, you could actually do the exact same thing by clicking through the Windows Azure portal and clicking from gallery. And this is what I was telling you about earlier, all the different platform images you can start your virtual machines off of. So in our case, since we're doing a migration, we're going to pick up one of those disks that I uploaded. But if you're creating a new virtual machine, this is what it would look like just to get started with. So to do a migration, you would click disks. And you see that I have the other two disks that I was going to upload as part of the application. I could just select those, walk through the wizard, and the virtual machine would boot up using that disk. So the next step would be, how do we actually get the rest of the virtual machines up there? Not a big jump. You already saw how to upload one virtual machine using CS Upload. So you'd use the same tool to upload the other two disks for the virtual machines. Now the difference is, we're actually going to need to configure endpoints and other connectivity method for the actual web farm. So let's go through and provision these guys. So this time around, I'll actually use a portal. So you can see our SQL virtual machine is booted up. You can see the disks that we uploaded, or that we configured in PowerShell. So we now have a SQL server that has two data disks attached to it, or data disk and a disk for logs. So now we want to add two web servers to the same application. So we can create a new virtual machine and pick from disk, and I'll pick ISVM1. This is a disk that I uploaded using CSUpload. And the other thing to note is whenever you're going through the provisioning process, you get to select the size of the virtual machine. So if you needed to provision a big SQL server, you could pick extra large with 8 cores and 14 gigs of RAM, or a small web server, in this case, would be small, depending on whatever what your application is. So the concept of cloud service, where you have a single cloud service that can hold multiple machines, this is a phase where you actually connect these two together. So a standalone virtual machine is going to create a new cloud service and no connectivity between virtual machines. To actually connect it to the existing SQL server we have, we select connect to existing virtual machine, and there's a SQL VM1 there. Now, that box is worded a little funny. It doesn't mean that you'll only be able to connect to SQL VM1. It means you'll be able to connect to all the VMs in that cloud service. And one thing to note here, since most of you guys haven't seen any of the IS talks, we're not going to actually configure availability sets now, but what an availability set does is if you configure more than one virtual machine that has similar behavior, like two SQL servers, two IS servers, four IS servers, whatever, if you put them in an availability set, what that does is it actually tells the Windows Azure Fabric Controller to split them up on separate hardware, separate actual physical racks in the data center. So you don't have a single point of failure even at the rack level in the data center. Okay, so once we click OK, it's actually going to create a new virtual machine. It's going to find a server with enough capacity in a data center, take this virtual hard disk, map it to it, and start booting the VM up. And what we'll need to do next is, one thing you'll notice is using the portal, you have to do a little bit of waiting, right? You have to serialize some of your operations. So while this is provisioning, I can't actually go back and add the other virtual machine. This is why I like PowerShell, because I can just tell it to do it all at once and it just does it. So we'll come back and add the other virtual machine here in just a bit. And then we'll configure load balancing for it as well, so you can see how the load balancer works. So virtual networking. Windows Azure Virtual Networking is, if you've read any of the press, if you've heard anything about it, almost everyone probably gets the impression that it's mainly used for creating a hybrid network, putting a VPN tunnel between your on-premises network and the public cloud. So it does a couple other things as well. That's obviously a key piece of it, is enabling that hybrid connectivity. But the other two things it does is it also provides persistent IP address requirements. So if you boot up a virtual machine, just like we did in a portal, if you boot up a virtual machine there, you'll get an IP address automatically. And if you reboot that machine or it gets serviced for health, it gets put on a new hardware, there's a good chance you'll get a different IP address. So if you're doing things like Active Directory, you have your domain DNS server up in the cloud, you know that Active Directory domain controllers aren't really, it's not recommended to swap the IP address of them, because all the Active Directory clients won't be able to find it anymore and your network is just whacked. So whenever you deploy a machine into a virtual network, all the machines in a virtual network are guaranteed to have the exact same IP address no matter how many times they're rebooted. So it is the solution for deploying anything that requires persistent IP address. A second reason you would need a virtual network is obviously to do hybrid. If you need a VPN tunnel between your on-premises data center and the public cloud, this is the way to do it. The third one is what I was talking about with cloud services. So cloud services act as a container for virtual machines. They also can act as a container for cloud services or for web and worker roles, which is our traditional PaaS roles. So the question is, how do you connect the existing services that we had with the new, with the virtual machines? Well, virtual networks allow you to do that. Cloud services, there can be multiple cloud services per virtual network. And every cloud service on the same virtual network has direct communication with each other. So this allows you to do cross-service connectivity. Okay, so before I move forward too far, I don't want to get ahead of myself on the demos, is I'm going to go ahead and provision the other virtual IS server. This will be ISVM2. And I will connect. As you can see, whenever we do the connect with multiple VMs, it shows SQL VM1 and ISVM1. But what you're actually adding to is you're adding to the cloud service as a container. So if you just select either one, you'll be in the same boat. All right. So once this one's booted up, then we'll walk through actually configuring the load balancer. So to actually deploy a virtual network requires a few steps, and you don't have to memorize all these, obviously, but it's something to keep in mind that deploying a virtual network is not something that you can just go point-click, create a virtual network, and move existing resources into the virtual network. It actually does require you to define and plan all of the networking, how it's going to be built up front, and then deploy your services into the virtual network. So if you've answered the question, yes, I need a virtual network, plan the VNet first, and then plan how to get the application actually into it. So the first step is to define an affinity group. And if you're new to Windows Azure, all an affinity group is something that is a grouping that says all these resources in the same group are going to be in the same region. They're going to be really close together, data center locality. They're not going to be, in North U.S. and South U.S. are all going to be in South U.S. or wherever you define the affinity group at. And the next thing you'll do is you'll define your address space and your subnets. So the address space is basically the big bucket of IP addresses that can be used in your virtual network. And the subnets are which subnet range the virtual machine is going to be allocated from. Now, one thing to keep in mind is we don't actually support broadcasts in the cloud. So if you're a networking person, you're like, well, if you don't support broadcasts, why are you doing subnets? Because you can't have broadcast storms. If you're not a networking guy, don't worry about it. There are two reasons. In the future, Windows Azure Virtual Networking, there is a roadmap where we will be able to define access control lists between subnets. So you could have services on one subnet that can define traffic patterns from other services on the other subnets. So this is more of a knowing the roadmap and planning for it type strategy. The other area you need if you're deploying a virtual network and you're doing on-premises hybrid networking is you need the IP address of your on-premises gateway service. And I'll explain this a little bit more in detail, but whenever you establish the site-to-site network, something has to be listening on your end of the network to establish that connection. And this is where we get the IP address from. So if you're really interested in the gory details, this is what it actually looks like. It's basically a big XML configuration file that defines all your network settings. And this is the section that actually defines your on-premises virtual network. So basically it shows the address space of everything that's on the local network that you want to connect to the cloud and the actual virtual private network gateway address. This is your Cisco device sitting in your data center. So there are a few steps to actually create and configure the gateway. First, you actually provision a gateway in the Windows Azure portal or PowerShell. You retrieve the IP address and a shared key from this gateway, and then you actually go configure your device. Then there's quite a bit of other deployment details that go into actually configuring your application for a virtual network. Like I said, a virtual network requires everything to be in an affinity group. So that means your cloud service, whenever I created the cloud service earlier and I passed a dash location parameter, that means it's going to go in the East Region data center. Well, if I'm going to work with a virtual network, instead of working with a data center, I actually need to specify the region. And then also you need the storage count for where your virtual hard disks are going to go and any other deployment settings like your virtual network and DNS settings. So let me jump back over. I think I jumped ahead too far on my demos, but and kind of show you how to, now that you know all about it, really advanced virtual networking, we're going to step back 10 feet and talk about basic load balancing settings. So these are our two web servers that we provisioned, that we booted up. And what we want to do is we want to configure so we can allow incoming traffic on port 80 for these guys. So to do that, you can go into the configuration. And right now you can see that the only thing we have is a remote desktop protocol enabled. And add a new endpoint. And for the endpoint, you just basically give it whatever name you want. And the name is actually useful because if you make a standardized method of configuring these endpoints, you can use tools like PowerShell or other automation utilities to find and update these program, you know, in an automated fashion. So for the load balancer, we're just going to open up port 80 and click OK. And usually that's really all it takes to open up web traffic to your application. Now, to do the load balancer, it requires us to wait for this endpoint to be created, go to another virtual machine, and add another endpoint on that one as well. So we'll kind of jump back and forth on this one, but while we're waiting for our endpoints to kind of figure out how they work, we're going to go ahead and talk about virtual networking. Hey, Corey, glad you could make it. So, virtual networking. So this is the actual configuration of what it looks like to have a hybrid tunnel between your on-premises network and the public cloud. This is a configured VPN tunnel. You can see we have a little bit of data in, data out. It's obviously not real busy. And one thing to note is the gateway IP address. This is the IP address of the Windows Azure Gateway that's going to connect back to your data center that you'll need to configure your Cisco router, your Juniper router, or whatever VPN device you're using to accept connections from. And you can see on the configuration tab that we have multiple subnets made, and we have And we also have a DNS server defined in this network. And what this DNS server actually points to is an on-premise Active Directory server. So it's actually pointing back to a machine running in Building 40 in Redmond. It's under my desk. So if we wanted to configure a new one of these, I'm not going to walk through all of it, but I'll kind of give you a taste of what it would actually take to get you, to create one of these, is you would create a network, and you can actually define it all in a portal, or you can actually have an XML configuration file that your network administrator has already defined for you and went through and did the subnetting, made sure the subnets in the cloud aren't going to clash with subnets on your private network, and handed you to import. So down at the bottom, there's an import button. Where I can pick a virtual network. And I'll show you this real quick. Yeah, I use Visual Studio to edit my networks. So this is the actual network configuration. It's real similar to what we showed on the PowerPoint slides. It has your subnets. If you notice 10.8.1/24, your actual IP address of your gateway device. So what I'm going to do is I browse to that, and I'm just going to click Next. That's not good. Maybe it doesn't want me to update. Oh, because I don't have the existing network. So let me do the same thing and actually create it through the portal. And here's where you're going to give it your big bucket of IP addresses. So this would be, in my case, it's going to be a 10.8-0.0/16, which means I think I could theoretically create, I don't remember my subnetting that well, but it's like 48,000 or maybe even more hosts in this cloud, which I don't think you'd want to recommend. But then you could actually define multiple subnets. And then you could define as many as you wanted at this point. Define the different subnets for that address space. So what you're really doing is you're slicing up that address space, and that's where your virtual machines are actually going to be allocated in. And you can create, can or you can choose an existing AD or domain DNS server, which is what I have here. And if you want, you can configure connection to your local network. So I already have it configured here. I have the gateway subnet on 4. And this is pretty much all you need to do to actually configure the DNS or the virtual network settings. Once the virtual network settings are configured here, you need to provision a gateway, which is another button. It takes about 10 minutes because it actually spins up some worker roles under the covers. Get the gateway IP address and a key, and actually that's when you go back and configure your device. So I'm going to RDP into a session that has this device. Just to kind of show you the possibilities here. So this is a console for a Cisco ASA 5505 admin tool. I know most networking people actually use a telnet and SSH configure, but I'm not that good. So. But all the different settings you see at the bottom. Oops. These are basically the virtual networks that I've defined doing tests and demos and stuff. It's really the same concept. You're defining the local network, and then you define the remote network. And whenever you're walking through that configuration, you give it the key you get from the Windows Azure portal, and suddenly they connect, and you can actually access each other like they're on the same network. Okay, so virtual machines, let's go back, rewind a little bit. You learned advanced virtual networking, so I'm going to show you how to load balance the endpoint. So our second virtual machine has been configured. So if we actually want to configure this in the load balancer, we would then go back and add an endpoint again, and this time we're going to load balance an existing endpoint. And this is the one we created on ISVM1. And how this works is whenever you're under the covers when you're creating endpoints, you're creating an endpoint on one virtual machine, you create an endpoint on another virtual machine, and whenever you create these endpoints, you can give them a similar load balancing set name. So LBWeb on both, and the load balancer is smart enough to join those by their name and actually create them as in the load balancer. And that's it. Going through those two settings, and you now have a load balance web server, or two load balance web servers, I should say. So Active Directory. Again, how many people have applications that require Active Directory? Decent amount, okay. How many of your organizations, your companies, would consider moving an application to the cloud that does have a dependency on Active Directory? Maybe, future. So there is a need for having Active Directory in the cloud, and most of the time it's not because you want to spin up a domain controller and say you spun up a domain controller. It's usually because you have an application that has a dependency on AD. SharePoint is a good example. Any other internet applications that are in an Active Directory domain, usually they use Windows authentication so you don't have to log in every time. And that's usually the best use case for having AD at the cloud. There's a couple other reasons. The second reason that a lot of people could use Active Directory in the cloud for is for failover, a backup. So you have domain controllers in your enterprise, and you want a backup up in the cloud where you don't have to manage it on-premise just in case something goes down. Well, you can now deploy DC directly in the cloud and have it act as a backup for your existing domain controllers. The third scenario is one we want to see someday, is the server's a primary authentication for a cloud-only data center. So this is new companies that have either built all their infrastructure or have moved their infrastructure all out to the cloud. So deploying AD in a Windows Azure VM takes a few steps. We have a white paper coming out on it soon, so don't worry about memorizing all this. But the key thing is AD can only be deployed in a virtual network. So the steps that we saw in the portal, you will have to do before you do this. You can try to deploy it in a VM you just boot up out of the portal, but eventually the IP address will change and your AD will be broke. So whenever you deploy your cloud service into there's a little bit of an architecture for this, is if you're actually deploying a domain controller in the cloud, you need to split this up into two separate cloud services. So you will want to create your DC in the standalone model, boot your domain controller up, and if it's extending existing AD, that's when you would also provision in, or you would join the existing domain. And then secondary, for your applications that actually, or your member servers that join that domain, they would be booted up into a secondary cloud service. And the reason is whenever you boot up a DC up in the cloud, you need to tell your other VMs what the DNS IP address, what the IP address of that domain controller is. And before it's booted up, you don't know what the IP address is. So you boot the DC up, configure it, run DC promo, join an existing AD, whatever you need to do. And then in the second cloud service, you can actually specify that new domain controller's IP address as your DNS entry. So whenever it boots, it automatically finds the right place. It's a little convoluted, but it's not as complicated as it sounds. This is really what that architecture looks like. On the left, you have a cloud service that has your Active Directory. It has, you know, a single server here. And probably hard to read, but AD is booted up in a cloud service on its own, and on the right, you have AD clients, and the only significant difference between these two cloud services is the DNS settings on the cloud service on the right point to the cloud service on the left, and that's how they're able to, every time they get provisioned, automatically find out what domain they're in. So a couple other things you can do in with Active Directory. This is just some of the architecture diagrams I want to cover a little bit. Whenever you're provisioning Active Directory in the cloud, some of the architectures you may choose to have just all Active Directory on-premise, don't move anything out to the cloud, but have a tunnel back on-premises where your servers could boot up and be provisioned inside of Active Directory. So this is probably going to be how a lot of companies start with, because they don't want to just pick up their Active Directory and move it straight out to the cloud for security reasons or whatever. Active Directory administrators are usually pretty paranoid, and rightfully so. They have a lot of really sensitive data. The second scenario that, depending on the application, is whenever you actually do put a full-blown Active Directory domain controller up in the cloud. And the biggest difference between these two is every time someone authenticates an IIS or SQL server, it gets traveled over the VPN tunnel, does authentication back with the domain controller, and then it has to come back. With this, we actually shortcut that authentication scenario. So if you're using applications that are very chatty, like SharePoint is a good example there, is it's probably best to have a domain controller up in the cloud, very close locality to the other servers. And the third scenario is probably what a lot of customers will do whenever they're actually deploying SharePoint or another application like it, is to have a separate domain in the cloud. So they'll have their corporate domain on-premises, and they'll have a separate domain up in the cloud that's completely distinct from their on-premises one. And the only thing the hybrid tunnel would be accommodate resources. So if you're accessing databases, you're accessing file servers, that kind of thing, it would actually not carry Active Directory replication traffic. So let's talk a little bit about deploying AD. I can kind of explain how the whole two cloud services concept works. So the first thing I'll show is that we actually do have a domain controller booted up in the cloud. So this domain controller is actually in a cloud service up in the cloud, but it has extended that same server that I have connected back in building 40. So if I pull up Active Directory users and computers, you can see I actually have quite a few different domain controllers. The one in this particular subscription is TECloud-DC. The MW2K8R2 is a really junky server under my desk in Washington, and the other two domain controllers are a part of a couple other subscriptions that I have set up, but they're all running up in the cloud. The really nice thing about running AD for your managing your infrastructure is you can do things like group policy. So if you look in this one, I have a container called Azure VMs that whenever I booted my VMs up, I had them automatically join this container. So what that means is I can actually apply a group policy to this container, so every new server provisioned in Azure automatically gets inherited group policy settings. So I can enforce security with antivirus, I can enforce firewall rules, whatever I need to do happens automatically from AD. So now the question is, what happens if you need to provision new servers? How do I actually get this into the domain? Well, your typical reaction would be, okay, so if I need a new server, I'll click the gallery, I'll pick the OS image, wait for it to boot up, log in, join the domain. But what happens if you have, 30 servers to do that with? Do you really want to sit there and log into the server and manually join the domain 30 times? So we can automate this. So Windows Azure Service Management API provides provisioning capabilities where we can specify the Active Directory join information whenever we boot the VM up. So to do that, in PowerShell, you basically, actually before I show deploying the machines, I'll show you how to deploy that domain controller. Maybe that'll make more sense of the chicken and egg problem. So in this script right here, I have two DNS settings I'm going to set. One of them is, that's not right. This one I was looking for. I have one DNS setting I was going to set. The new Azure DNS one is pointing to this on-premise DNS server. So this is the one, the DC under my desk. So we set that. And then we create the domain controller here with this PowerShell code. And all it's really doing is it's taking the stuff that we set here and it's passing it to the Windows Azure provisioning engine. So whenever Windows Azure boots up, it'll automatically say, okay, so the user told me to join the fabricam.com domain, use the administrator username with the fabricam domain, and whenever it's provisioned on the DNS subnet. And that's really all it takes. Whenever you run through this code, the machine will boot up and it'll automatically be domain joined. And then to DC promo it, you obviously log in and run DC promo. Now what's unique about this is we don't know the IP address of the DNS server. So we at this point, we can't add other servers to the same and have it point to this AD server because we don't know the IP address of it as yet. So after this is run, we will have this virtual machine booted up, T-Cloud DC, and we can actually get the IP address of it. So we could log in, and we can type in ipconfig, get the IP address back, and then we can provision our new servers that way. You don't actually have to log in. From PowerShell, you can actually get a lot of information from the server itself. So any command that manipulates a virtual machine in PowerShell takes two arguments. It takes the name of the cloud service and the actual VM that you want to manipulate. So this command, all it will do is actually go and get all the useful information you need. Or maybe not. Maybe I typed it wrong. Oh, yeah, I had the wrong service name. Oh, hold on. All right, so this is what I was looking for. So whenever you type in get Azure VM, it'll dump out all kinds of useful information for you. And one of them happens to be the IP address of the virtual machine you're looking at. And that IP address is not the public one that you access over the internet. That's the one that you access on the private network within the cloud service. So 10.7.2.4 is what we would want to configure our other VMs to point to as their DNS server. So how we would do other VMs is here's how our DNS configuration would look. We'd have two entries this time, one of them that points to the cloud DNS server and the other one that points to the on-premises DNS server. And we give it the exact same domain join settings. And at this point, we can add as many virtual machines as we wanted. So we could actually run the script, and we could spin up four virtual machines, you know, using the Windows Server image and two servers running the SQL image, whatever we wanted to do. What this gives you the capability to do is that first bullet, whenever I was talking about what motivates you to move to the cloud, it's agility. You don't have to actually wait and provision servers. You don't even have to wait, you know, just like you don't want to wait for the hardware to get here, you don't want to have to wait to log in and join the domain every time. You can just run a simple script that uses our service management API and actually provision whole entire farm workloads. So you could have multiple servers that all had the application predefined on them in an image and just add them as you need them. So if you needed four servers for this team and eight servers for this team, from a simple script, you can spin them up in, you know, minutes. Okay, so a couple other things that, as you're migrating applications out to the cloud, you'll have to be concerned with and understand how they work, is managing data. So how do you manage data up in the cloud? We already know that your hard drives, you're not actually dealing with hard drives, you're dealing with stuff out in Windows Azure Storage, which of course deals with hard drives, but it's abstracted from you. So to you as the application owner, how do you configure this storage? Well, each data disk that you add to your virtual machine, just kind of think of it as a single disk on a single disk controller, and if you have configured storage for SQL Server or Windows Server or whatever before, you can think of that as individual disk controllers with spindles. So as you add more disks, you get more I/O capacity. So your best goal whenever you're looking for disk I/O is to spread spread I/O across multiple disks if you can. SQL has a really nifty functionality for this called SQL file groups, where they can take a single database and spread it across multiple disks. Host caching we also have functionality for host caching at the disk, where basically the hypervisor will use the local physical disk to cache I/O, reads and writes. By default, we have no caching enabled on data disks, and on our OS disk, we actually do have caching enabled. So if you haven't been to one of the Windows Azure sessions yet, always remember that you do not put anything that needs to be crashed or consistent on the OS disk without first modifying the cache settings, because if we have a failure and the data is cached, it could corrupt your data. So the moral to the story is any data that you want to put on a VM, always put it on a data disk. That's really what it's for. And you should always plan for your storage capacity. Every data disk that you can add to a virtual machine can be up to a terabyte, and our biggest VM can currently have 16 data disks. So you can easily spin up a virtual machine with 16 terabytes of storage. So this kind of gives you a little bit better idea of what the capabilities are of storage. Your OS disk has a max capacity of 127 gigs, but every data disk can be up to a terabyte in size. And always remember not to put anything important on your D drive. So a couple of good examples of what I mean by databases is whenever you deploy Active Directory, the Active Directory has a DIP database that you should not put on the C drive unless you actually were to go change the default host caching behavior of the disks. SQL database and transaction logs, same thing. They should go on separate disks. Or if you do put them on the C drive, like for small databases, make sure that you change that host caching setting. So from a management perspective, how many of you have management software to manage virtual machines right now? How many of your companies do, like System Center or Quest Software or HP? Okay. So to a virtual machine, or virtual machines in Windows Azure aren't significantly different. As a matter of fact, from a software-to-software management perspective, they're not any different at all. They just boot up in their Windows. So existing processes for patching operating systems will continue to work. The key will be, obviously, how can your application, the management software, actually connect to the VMs. So as long as they're over virtual networking like Brooklyn, or even without the virtual networking aspect, tools like System Center have gateway capabilities where even if they're not on the same network, they're not on the same domain, they can compress and send you management monitoring data over the external internet. For Azure-specific automation, because most of these management software is not going to know too much about how Azure works. You know, System Center doesn't know how to provision a new virtual machine in Azure yet. For those kind of Azure-specific automation tests, just use PowerShell. We made it where we can automate pretty much everything. So I'll show you a few more examples in PowerShell. That's just my favorite. I don't know why. But so just some of the things you can do in PowerShell. You've already seen how you can actually spin up virtual machines. You can configure them in AD. But what other things can you do? So one of the things that has been some discussion lately internally is how to, you know, we showed that first scenario where you have a bunch of servers that you're not using after hours. How do you actually accomplish that task in the cloud? How do you not pay for it? Well, if a virtual machine is provisioned, we pay for it. So as long as we're taking up cores on some server, it's being paid for. So how do you work, you know, how do you get efficient with the cloud whenever, you know, if your application, you have 10 servers at 5:30, everyone goes home, no one's using them. What do you do to get that efficiency back? One of the things you could do that's pretty straightforward is just to delete the virtual machine. Whenever you delete the virtual machine in Windows Azure, it doesn't delete the underlying storage. So the underlying storage, all your data is still there. And granted, you are paying for the underlying storage, but it's much cheaper than paying for the hardware. So you delete the virtual machines, and then 9 o'clock the next morning, when everyone comes back to work, you reprovision the machines. But you don't want to get in the habit of, you know, 5:30 before you go home, go into the portal, click a bunch of machines and hit delete, wait for them to be finished, and then go home. And then hopefully you didn't miss traffic and get back to work and spin the virtual machines back up. And, you know, because if there's a wreck, your entire company might be waiting on you to get to work. So what you really need here is some automation, some ways of spinning up virtual machines and deleting them. So we have a couple of ways to do that. I have a couple of just real simple scripts that'll kind of give you an idea. They could obviously be a lot more elaborate. So here is a script. I created a virtual machine a little while earlier. I can zoom it down right. I created a virtual machine earlier where that has an endpoint, it has a couple of data disks, and I exported it using a commandlet called export Azure VM. And all export Azure VM does is it takes all those configuration settings, your disk settings, your endpoints, and it dumps it out to an XML file. So the nice thing about that is you can then export it, delete the virtual machine, and then later use import to actually rehydrate it and put it back up and running. And the only code to actually make that work is that second line right here. Restore the VM. You call import Azure VM, pass it the XML file, tell it what data center to put it in, and that's pretty much it. Now, if you want to take a look at that XML file, it's not overly pretty, but you can see that it's basically all the stuff that you would recreate in a portal or in PowerShell. It's all the stuff that's important for your virtual machine. It has your disk settings, your cache settings, endpoints, etc. So what you can do with that script, you know, just being simple, we don't want to have to buy expensive software to do this because the whole point of saving money is just have a simple scheduled task to actually add it and remove it. So I have two scheduled tasks. One of them, this runs at would run at 5 a.m. every day. That'll actually add the VM back, boot it up. And I have another one at 7 o'clock every day that removes it, so we're not paying for it. So we're only paying for these VMs when we're using it. In the script, this entire solution consists of calling PowerShell and passing the PS1 file to actually remove it. So I think I left it where the virtual machine's not there. Oh, hold on. See, I said it was an easy script and it failed. Actually, I think the piece I forgot is a service name. We'll try that one more time. Usually if it takes a while, it means it's working. So we'll take our XML file, has all the settings, it's importing them in, and it's actually creating the virtual machine back up in the cloud. And of course, this is the service that would actually, this is a script that would actually get rid of it. So you can see we're passing the same server name, we're passing the application or the VM name, and we're passing the path where it's actually going to export those settings to. So every day we'd basically export whatever settings to make sure that we're always up to date, remove the virtual machine with the next line, and we're no longer paying for that compute. Then the next morning comes in and rehydrates. Okay, so a couple of other interesting things we can do here is if you just want to know the status of all your virtual machines, we have a real simple commandlet called get Azure VM. Okay, so you can see that we have five virtual machines running. One of them has stopped because that's one that we just provisioned and the other four already booted up. If we wanted to get rid of all these virtual machines, we could pipe get Azure VM to remove Azure VM, and it'll actually just obliterate every virtual machine in your cloud. So it's got a lot of capabilities. And one thing that's really nice about it is that we can actually dynamically update these virtual machines as they're running up in the cloud. So if I wanted to add additional disk space to my web server, I could say get Azure VM. And then what this will do is instead of returning back a list of all the virtual machines, it'll only return the one that I'm interested in modifying. So you can see all the different properties of it. And then I can modify it by adding, say if we wanted to add a terabyte of storage because we just have a lot of web logs. We'll say 1,023 gigs is what I think will work. Tell it's going to be on our first line. And we do have to give it a label. So three simple lines of code, and we can add a terabyte of storage to our VM. So pretty much anything that you can do whenever you provision a virtual machine, you can do on updating as well. You can add or you can actually remove the disks. You can change the caching. You can add or remove endpoints. If you put your virtual machine size too small or too large, you can actually change the size of it. That does require a reboot for that one. So it's all about automation. And you can script these to update multiple virtual machines at the same time. So instead of passing the server name and name, I could actually just say get Azure VM, and I could add a terabyte of disk storage to every virtual machine in my subscription. So. So the last area I want to talk about is infrastructure as a service and platform as a service. So how many of you, again, have actually ever deployed a webinar worker role? A few? Okay. So webinar worker roles are the traditional compute resources we had in Windows Azure up until just a few days ago. They're really useful because once you're deployed, you really don't have to manage the actual application infrastructure around it, you really just have to focus on the application. You define what the application is, deploy it, Windows Azure detects if it's going bad, it will reboot it, it'll patch it, you can add more instances dynamically, etc. So the question is, how can you actually take these cloud services and put them next to virtual machines? So there's a couple of different patterns that you'll see as you build these applications. The first one is connecting cloud apps via the public endpoints. So what that means is instead of actually having them on the same physical network, you're using the public endpoints of each cloud service to connect to each other. The second model is actually doing virtual networking, and we'll talk about that in a bit. And there's a third model that's hopefully coming in the future that will make deploying applications like these really easy. So the first model is the cloud service via virtual IP, or the VIP. So in this, we have two cloud services. We have a web role in Cloud Service 1, and we have a SQL Server, something in a virtual machine in Cloud Service 2. And what it's doing here is we're actually connecting over the public internet through the endpoints. And really, using this model, the SQL Server could be accessed from any client, whether they're in Windows Azure or not. They could be accessed from a web application in Amazon. Obviously, the biggest benefit here is you don't have to deal with virtual networking, so it's really simple. You just open up a public endpoint and configure the firewall for whatever virtual machine you're using is, and then the other applications can just access it over that public IP address and port. We still have the concept of, with this, you still retain the concept of doing a VIP swap with your stateless roles. And for the most part, it's just really easy. Now, the cons is obviously since we're going through multiple layers of load balancing, we're going to increase the latency. So if you're doing really heavy I/O against your SQL Server, it's probably not the best approach. Obviously, you do have a little management overhead because you're managing multiple cloud services too. Second approach is configuring your applications to all be in the same virtual network. The other one is a little bit less secure as well because you are putting your service up on a public endpoint too. With this approach, you have everything all on a private network. So you have very fast, low latency connectivity between your web role and your service, whether it's SQL Server, Active Directory, or whatever. It also gives you the capability of doing stuff like advanced connectivity, like AD. You know, if you still, your application does have the requirement for persistent IP addresses or other stuff like ThinkCom. You know, if you've ever done any kind of DCOM programming, it requires ranges of 5,000 ports. You can't really do that by individual endpoints the other way. Here you can. You have full open network, so you could actually do DCOM up in the cloud again. Not that you'd want to, but you could. The weaknesses here is the VNet's obviously has a little bit of complexity. And the other thing that you should always keep in mind is by default, the other way, we get name resolution. Whenever you boot your virtual machines up, they can ping each other. You just type in IS1 and VM1, SQL VM1, and they know who each other are. That doesn't happen when you're in a virtual network. In a virtual network, you're expected to provide name resolution for your services if you need it. Otherwise, you might just use the IP addresses because they don't change. But if you do need name resolution, that's something that your service will have to provide. The third model, which doesn't yet exist, is a single cloud service where you can deploy web and worker roles all on the same cloud service as virtual machines. Hopefully this will come in the future, but the benefit is they're all on the same private network. You have a single deployment. It's very low latency. You'll get Windows Azure provided DNS. Weaknesses, no VIP swap yet, but that's actually not such a big deal whenever you consider the alternatives. So from a summary, the main thing you should keep in mind is whenever you're planning this out, it is truly infrastructure as a service. It's not like platform as a service where you just focused on your application and you put it up in the cloud and it just worked. This is just like running a private cloud on your data center, except you don't have to manage the hardware. So it does take a little bit more planning and expertise. You'll need to plan your network requirements. You'll need to make sure that whenever you do define a virtual network, for instance, that your subnets up in the cloud don't overlap with subnets on your on-premises, because you know you just don't want duplicate IP addresses popping up on your network. You need to plan for storage performance and capacity. You'll have to think these things through again. Not that you ever did if you weren't on PaaS in the first place. But the other thing to keep in mind is just like your existing on-premises data center, existing tools should work, so monitoring applications should still work. You don't have to invest in a whole new array of software and services to make any of this happen. It's just you should really try to envision virtual machines and virtual networking as an extension of your own data center. I think that's really the main thing you want to get across. And finally, if you are building new applications in Windows Azure, whether it's Windows Azure websites or web and worker roles, make sure that you always remember that if you do get blocked, you have dependencies like, oh, I suddenly remember I need SQL Server, or I suddenly need Microsoft message queuing or whatever, that you can potentially use virtual machines to unblock those dependencies and move forward on your new application development. So look for more content if you're looking for more, if you didn't memorize all the steps to deploy AD. Really surprised if you didn't, but we will have training kits, hands-on labs, we'll have PowerPoints, all the stuff that you see here, we're gonna have lots and lots of really detailed infrastructure and service hands-on labs that are coming out literally within the next day or two. So just keep an eye out for the Windows Azure training kit. It should be out in the next few days. And you can actually walk through and deploy your own domain controller up in the cloud. Twitter, my blog. So I'll be posting regular, really complicated updates on how to deploy infrastructure service and make it look easy. So any questions? Sure. Now, did it say Asian or agent?
Asian. Azure.
Azure. Thank you. So you're asking if I, are you talking about SQL Server, the full product?
Yeah.
Okay. So SQL, right, so SQL Servers, are you mumbling over there, Corey? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'll repeat the question just so. The question was, how does licensing work both, I think, on Windows Server and on SQL Server?
That was it.
So the license for Windows Server is actually supplied by the cloud, right? So you pay per hour, and the Windows Server license is a part of that payment. You cannot move your license for Windows Server to the cloud. So you end up paying for that in the cloud, and the license stays on premises. For SQL Server, you can actually, depending on using license mobility, which is an SA, a software assurance solution, and it allows you to move that SQL Server license to the cloud. And there's a whole bunch of documentation, as there always is for licensing, of sort of how it all works and so on and so forth. But yes, you can take your SQL Server license and run it in Windows Azure using license mobility. It doesn't actually require you to move the exact VHD, right? The license is what moves, and so you can just install SQL Server in the cloud and then use your license there. But that's the way it works.
There is
an image in the gallery today that's actually eval, so it's a free license right now in the cloud, and so that's the offer that you can use while you're running in the cloud, directly from the gallery. Did I answer your question? Yes. For any running of SQL Server, the license has to come from you. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.